pulls a spectacular face, then passes it back to me. Helena's very pretty. Yes, so? So? So I thought you'd be slavering over that. Should I be? Honestly, Monty, I've never quite understood who's really got a hold on you. Do you want to know if I'm a bugger? She winces at the crass word, but then says, It seems a fair question considering I've seen your hands all over Richard Peel and Theodosia Fitzroy. Oh, dear Theodosia, my girl. I collapse backward into the sofa cushions. I remain inconsolable over losing her. I do not want to talk about this, especially with my little sister. I came down here for the sole purpose of getting drunk enough to sleep and avoid venturing anywhere near this subject. But Felicity goes on staring at me like she's waiting for an answer. I take an uncivilized swipe at my mouth with my sleeve, which would have earned me a cuff from my father had we been at home. Why does it matter who I run around with? Well, one is illegal, and a sin, and the other is also a sin if you aren't married to her. Are you going to give me the fornication without the intention of procreation is of the devil and a crime lecture? I believe I could recite it from memory by now. Monty, perhaps I am trying to procreate with all these lads, and I'm just very misinformed about the whole process. If only Eaton hadn't thrown me out. You're avoiding the question. What was the question? Are you? Oh, yes. Am I a sodomite? Well, I've been with lads, so... Yes. She purses her lips, and I wish I hadn't been so forthright. If you'd stop, Father might not be so rough on you, you know. Oh, my. Thank you for that earth-shattering wisdom. Can't believe I didn't think of that myself. I'm simply suggesting, don't bother. He might ease up. Well, I haven't much choice. Really? She crosses her arms. You haven't a choice in who you bed? No, I mean I haven't much choice in who it is I want to bed. Of course you do. Sodomy's a vice, same as drinking or gambling. Not really. I mean, yes, I enjoy it, and I've certainly abstained from abstinence. But I'm also rather attracted to all the men I kiss, and the ladies as well. She laughs like I've made a joke. I don't. Sodomy has nothing to do with attraction. It's an act, a sin. Not for me. But humans are made to be attracted to the opposite sex, not the same one. That's how nature operates. Does that make me unnatural? When she doesn't reply, I say, Have you ever fancied anyone? No, but I believe I understand the basic principles of it. I don't think you really can until it's happened to you. Have you? Have I what? Ever fancied someone? Oh. Well, yes. Girls? Yes. Lads? Also yes. Percy? I had felt her winding up to that, but it still catches me on the chin. I don't say anything, which is answer enough, and she gives me a sideways glance. Don't look so surprised, neither of you is very subtle. Neither of us? Well, yes, it does take two. Isn't Percy? No, I interrupt. Percy is not. No. You mean you've never... Nope. I take another long drink. The bottle collar rattles against the neck. Oh. I suppose I assumed as you lean towards lads, and the two of you are always so familiar with each other. We are not. You are. Fine. But I'm like that with a lot of people. Not like you are with Percy. And he's certainly not. Percy's so stoic and polite with everyone but you. And I've never known him to be, you know, involved with anyone. Lad or lady. He hasn't, it occurs to me suddenly. Or, if he has, I've never been privy to that information. He's never mentioned being sweet on someone or spoken of anyone fondly, and for all our junkets, I am the only person I've ever known Percy to kiss. Even if it isn't, you know, romantic, Felicity goes on, it's hard not to see. You're the kind of pair that makes everyone around them feel as though they're missing out on a private joke. We sit still for a minute, neither speaking. The fire pops and flails, spitting out sap. Then she says, It's a relief, actually. I wasn't certain you had it in you to truly care for anyone. I slouch down a little farther and nearly slide right off the sofa. It's very slick upholstery. It would have been good if it was someone who wasn't my best mate, or someone I could actually be with. Or, you know, a woman. I thought you liked women too. I do, sometimes, but that doesn't mean I don't like Percy more than anyone else. Felicity presses her fingers to her temples. I'm sorry, Monty. I'm really trying to understand this, and I... can't. It's fine. I don't understand it most of the time. What does Percy think? Not a clue. Sometimes I think he knows I'm smitten and ignores it. Sometimes I think he's just thick. Either way, he doesn't seem to feel the same. It must be difficult, she says. I want to throw my arms around her for acting as though this conversation is ordinary. But as hard as she's trying, any more honesty would likely burst her head open. Because Percy goes so deep inside me, like veins of gold grown into granite. I think again about our kiss in Paris. His hand on my knee in the carriage when the highwayman ambushed us. Lying side by side on the roof of the livery stable. It makes me ache to line them up like that, each of those moments that fall just short of where I wish they would land. Not very enjoyable, no. What are your expectations, exactly? If Percy did feel the same way about you, what would happen? You can't be together, not like that. You could be killed for it if you were found out. They've been sentencing Mollies by the score since the clap raid. Doesn't matter, does it? Percy's good and natural and probably only fancies women, and I am... not. Silence again. Then Felicity reaches out and puts a hand upon my shoulder. As far as physical affection goes, we're a fairly delinquent family, so coming from her, it's a momentous gesture. I'm sorry, she says. What for? You've had a rough go. Everyone has a rough go. I've had it far easier than most people. Maybe, but that doesn't mean your feelings matter less. Ugh, feelings. I take a long drink, then pass her the bottle. She has another delicate sip. You were right. It's less horrid now. It occurs to me then that perhaps getting my little sister drunk and explaining why I screw boys is not the most responsible move on my part. I almost snatch the bottle back, though it feels rather hypocritical to take a stand for sobriety. So instead I say, I wish I could be better for you. She looks over at me and I duck my head, shame sinking its teeth in. I'm older, and I know I'm supposed to be an example, I don't know, at least someone you aren't embarrassed of. You do fine. I don't. You're right, you don't. But you're getting better. And that isn't nothing. 16. Felicity and I stay up much later than either of us intends. I finally go above, at her insistence, as she says kipping up in the library is rather dramatic, to find Percy long asleep. He's balled up in bed, arms curled into him and knees pulled to his chest, but when I crawl in beside him he slides against me without waking, cheek to my shoulder, and I can't put any more space between us without going straight off the edge of the mattress. He shifts in his sleep, bare legs hooking around mine, and suddenly my body is very much out of my own control. Calm yourself, I instruct it firmly, and it doesn't really obey, so I pass the rest of the night with Percy nuzzled up to me, and me trying to think of anything but that. I hardly do more than doze. We've been lodging in dodgy inns for weeks, and yet this is the worst sleep I've had since Paris. When it finally seems an acceptable hour to rise, I'm exhausted and frustrated, and sort of hard, which is just unfair. I splash cold water on my face until my body seems to understand that a romp with Percy is not about to happen, then dress in my borrowed clothes and slip down the stairs before Percy stirs. If we are to quit this place today, I plan to at least have a word with Dante before and see what I can find out about his father's cure-alls. Perhaps play upon the tremendous debt he owes us, work the remember the great personal risk at which we brought your father's precious box back to you, so why not spill a bit of his alchemical secrets your sister was so keen on us not knowing yesterday, angle. A spacious kitchen with scuffed floors and high windows juts from the back of the house like a broken bone. Clusters of candles are stuck with wax along the table, and copper pots dangling above sway in the breeze filtering through the open window. It's not yet 8, and already hot as yesterday afternoon. Dante is crouched in the hearth, trying to coax chalky embers into flame, and I think for a moment I may have lucked into catching him on his own. But Helena is at the table, flipping through a stack of letters, her thumbnail between her teeth. A kettle filled with cold chocolate, waiting for the fire, sits beside her, alongside an amber cone of unnipped sugar and tongs. It's exceedingly odd to see the pair of them, Lord and Lady of the House, in the kitchen, preparing their own breakfast. They both look up as I enter. Dante stands quickly, bangs his head on the lip of the hearth, then wipes his sooty hands on his breeches, leaving 2 black palm prints. Mr. Montague.
Good morning. How did you sleep well?
Yes, I lie.
Thank you.
Sir? It's not a thing I'm accustomed to calling a man my own age, but he's got a house and likely his father's title on me, so I err on the side of awkward formality. Dante holds one of the candles to the kindling and blows until it catches, then tosses a log over top for the flames to curl their fingers around.
Is Mr. Newton...
He's still asleep, I say, to save him the trouble of finishing the sentence. He nods, and I nod, and Helena says nothing, and the sort of silence that makes a man want to talk about the weather falls between us. I take a spot at the table and help myself to a crusty bread roll off a tray in the center, just for something to do. It's staler than it looks. Helena's eyes narrow at the letter she's reading, face pinched until she catches me watching her, and composes herself. She refolds it and tosses it onto the stack on the table, then stands to hang the chocolate pot over the fire. There's a noise in the hallway, and a moment later a tousled Percy makes his entrance, sleepy and oblivious to the distress he caused me all night. Dante greets him with the same pup-like enthusiasm he offered me, though with less head-bashing this time. Percy slides down the bench to my side, just far enough away so that he won't crack me in the eye with his elbow when he starts to wrangle his hair back into a queue. As he fastens it, one long ringlet escapes and settles around his ear. I think about tucking it back into place for him, but take another bite of my roll instead.
"Sorry that we haven't much to eat," Helena says, then gives me a wry smile across the table. "You don't expect a trio to show up on your doorstep looking like someone dragged them from the sea with nothing but stolen property and a violin."
"Oh," Dante laughs, "the violin! I'd forgotten."
"Do you play?" Helena asks, looking between us.
"I do," Percy says.
"Well?"
"Well, what?"
"Do you play well?"
"Oh,
that depends upon your standard." "He plays very well," I interject. Beneath the table, Percy knocks his knee into mine. Helena sets a jar of grape molasses between us, spoon clanking against the crystal.
"Our father was a musician."
"I thought he was an alchemist," I say.
"A hobby musician," she qualifies.
"Mine as well," Percy says.
"My fiddle was his."
Dante, still crouched at the hearth and poking at the flames like a boy, pipes up.
"I have some of his music in the bedroom. My bedroom. The bedroom your... I saved it. If you like, if you want, you might..."
"I'm sure he's not interested, Dante," Helena says.
She's fetched mugs from a cabinet and is spreading them around the table before each place. When she bends over, the neckline of her dress dips so low I can see all the way to her navel. I was going for my bread, but nearly take a bite of the candle instead. Dante's face goes red, but Percy, bless him, says kindly, "I'll take a look at it. It'll be good to play some."
"He played mostly the glasses. So the songs, the music, I mean, it's meant to be performed on the cristallophone, but they might still..."
"If you're planning to depart this morning, there are diligences that will take you from the city center to the border," Helena interrupts.
"And you can hire a coach from there." It seems she's really shoving us out the door, but then she tacks on,
"Though if you're in no great rush, you're welcome to stay with us for a time."
Clearly there was no consult on this subject, but Dante drops the fire poker with a clatter.
What?
Helena ignores him and instead says to Percy and me, You've come so far, it seems a shame to leave so soon. And if you're touring, you should see Barcelona. Not many English tourists make it this far, and there's so much to do, the fort and the citadel.
We should be moving on, Percy starts, but Helena cuts him off. We're going to the opera on Friday night. You should at least stay until then.
I'm not sure we can compete with Paris, but it's grand to us.
She gives me a smile that's rather too predatory to accompany such a benign invitation. I can think of plenty of reasons to flee the house right then, ranging from that smile to all those death objects in the study are damned unnerving to, dear Lord, don't make me share a platonic bed with Percy again. But I'm not going anywhere until we have a chance to ask them about their father's cure-alls or whether there's anything they know that might help Percy, even if Helena seems as keen to keep an eye on us as I am on her. No secret so carefully guarded isn't worth knowing.
We'll have to speak with Felicity, Percy says, at the same time I start. Seeing the opera would be good.
But we're both interrupted by Dante's squeak of, Boiling! We all look over as the kettle lid clatters, foam spilling over the sides. The fire spits. Helena curses under her breath, whipping her skirt over her hands so she can hoist the kettle from the fire. Percy leaps up too, lifting the lid off the serving pot. A thin line of chocolate splatters from the spout as Helena pours, leaving a dark splotch along the linen. A few drops make it as far as the letter she tossed down the table, and I feel compelled to assist in some way, so I scoop them into a pile, out of her way.
Should I?
There's a box on the study desk, Helena says, still focused upon the chocolate pot.
Dante, please don't sit there. Fetch plates and the cutlery.
I pad into the study, tripping yet again on that damn loose floorcloth. The room is dark after the bright kitchen, windowless and all light swallowed by those bookshelves and that dark papering. The death masks seem to stare at me, empty eye sockets sunken into shadows. The tabletop is buried, same as the rest of the room, both with papers and with more of the paraphernalia, but there's a single box shuffled into one corner. I shift off a few layers of papyrus and a plaster casting to find a smattering of letters, the top one addressed to Mateu Robles. They must be quite piled up if they've still posed for their dead father. I shift the top few aside, curiosity getting the better of me. A few down, there's a sheet of fine, creamy stock with a green wax seal broken in one piece, the crest imprinted on it, the fleur-de-lis in triplicate. I nearly drop all the letters I'm holding. It's the crest of the Bourbons. The House of Bourbon controls Spain, so perhaps it's a tax letter, or news from friends in the court. Maybe that impression in the green wax did not come from the ring of the Duke who stole the box from the Robles siblings and attacked us in the woods. I toss the stack of mail onto the desk in a haphazard pile and snatch up the letter, unfolding it with fumbling fingers. Condessa Robles, in regard to our arrangement pertaining to your father's Lazarus key.
Did you get lost?
I whip around. Helena is standing with one hand on the doorframe, giving me a coy smile until she sees the letter in my hand. Then her eyes narrow.
What are you doing?
Just making certain this was the right place. She's still staring at me so vehemently that beads of sweat begin to congregate on the back of my neck. I almost thrust the letter behind my back, like that will somehow conceal my rather obvious treachery.
Come for breakfast, she says.
Oh, yes. I'm not certain what to do with the letter, but that question is answered when she steps forward and snatches it from me so hard that it rips, and I'm left with a scrap pinched between my thumb and forefinger. As we pass into the kitchen, she tosses the letter into the fire. I slide down to my spot at the table beside Percy, my hand on my lap still fisted around the scrap of the letter. As Helena turns her attention to breakfast, I smooth the paper out against my knee and glance down at the moniker upon it in blotted ink. Louis-Henri de Bourbon, Duke of Bourbon, Prince de Condé. Percy and I leave the breakfast table together, nearly colliding with Felicity at the top of the stairs as she comes down from her room, her hair mussed and her eyes still drooping. Before she can offer a good morning, I pull her into our bedroom, Percy on our heels, and shut the door. Look here, I found something. I unfold the torn scrap of the letter, kept tucked tight in my fist all through breakfast, which was quite a feat, and hold it for them to see. My sweating palm has smeared the ink, but the words are still legible. I tore it from a letter in their study. Felicity rubs at her eyes with her fists like she's still trying to wake.
The Duke of Bourbon.
The one I stole the box from.
He's writing to them.
Looks to be. Did you read the rest of the letter? Percy asks.
Just the first line, then Helena barged in. It was something about a Lazarus key. He said it belonged to their father.
Why is he writing to them if he's the one who stole the box? Percy asks.
Well, if he wanted it, perhaps he was trying to make a bargain first, Felicity offers. And they wouldn't comply, so he stole it?
We should find out what's in it, I say. I think they're lying when they say they don't know.
But it's theirs, Percy says. What they do with it is their business, not ours.
But we nearly died for it. And, in case you forgot, it might be something to help you. It's clearly some carefully guarded secret of Mateo Robles's, and his whole work was alchemical cures. It makes sense. We should stay here just for a few days and see what we can find.
But if they're in contact with the Duke, Percy starts.
I think Monty's right, Felicity interrupts him. We have no money, and we're going to wear ourselves out if we travel again so soon. You, especially, she looks to Percy, should take care of yourself.
Percy blows a sigh from his nose. The single errant curl about his ear flutters. I don't think it's a good idea to go courting trouble, is all.
We're not courting trouble, I say. Flirting with it, at most. I'm going to write to Lockwood, Felicity says, through the bank in Marseille. Tell him where we are and ask if he'll send funds to help restore us. Until then, if the Robleses will have us, we should stay here. And you, and here she looks to me, can do whatever sort of investigative work in that time that you'd like to, so long as you don't sour our hosts on us. Are we in agreement?
Yes, I say. It seems that, for the first time, my sister is enthusiastically on my side. Percy looks far dourer about it, but he nods.
Until then, Felicity says, perhaps we can learn about this Lazarus key.
17. It's 3 days before we manage to set aside some time for quality snooping. A disoriented 3 days of being intensely aware that we are strangers in a stranger's home, but with nowhere else to go. The first two we spend mostly sleeping, as our last few weeks suddenly seem to fall upon us all like a sack of bricks dumped from above. The third, Helena insists on accompanying us out of doors to see the city. Dante stays behind. He seems to live in the study. He takes up his post there every morning directly after breakfast and is still there when we turn in, which makes poking about for further correspondence with the Duke or anything about Mateo Robles's work difficult. We've all looted our respective rooms and found nothing, though Percy was almost entirely unhelpful to me once he discovered the stack of the father's music and decided his time was better spent riffling through that. The study seems the place for answers, and Dante seems disinclined to leave it, preferring the safety of the stuffy mausoleum his father left behind for him to populate. Investigative efforts foiled thoroughly by our exhaustion and his social anxiety. To my great surprise, it is Felicity who first pounces upon Dante. She's taken to this investigation with considerably more enthusiasm than anticipated, considering how tight she usually keeps her corsets laced. Since we arrived, the pair of them have been keeping up an ongoing conversation about chemistry and phrenology and electricism, and other words I don't know the meanings of, and he's quite a bit more keen on her than our initial interaction would have led me to believe was possible. Far more so than he seems to be toward Percy or me, though each time she attempts to nose anywhere near the subject of alchemy, he takes the conversational cul-de-sac back to safer ground. My initial hope that he might be inclined to spill secrets begins to slip. We find Dante in the study, not so much tidying as shifting the mess about, but he stops to listen as Felicity asks if there's a university nearby with a library we might visit.
There's a bookshop, he says. Down the corner. I mean, Around the corner, down the street and around the corner.
He flaps his hand for direction.
You may, might try that. Or we have books here, if you care to stay in.
His gaze scampers over Felicity. Then he goes red from his neck to his hairline.
Oh, that's kind, but I wanted to...
Felicity snatches a lie out of thin air with a speed that is frankly impressive.
I wanted to buy your father's book. We have copies around, I think.
Yes, but I'd like my own, to take with me when we go. It's not an airtight lie by any means, considering we have almost no money, and she first asked after a library. But before Dante can start to pick up the holes in it, she offers him a sweet smile. Not knee-weakening, per se, but perhaps charm is a bit more of a family attribute than I previously thought.
You can come with us, if you like.
The flush that had begun to fade from his cheeks flares again, like a stoked fire.
No, no. I think I'll stay.
Oh!
He calls us back as we reach the door, and says to Percy,
I heard you yesterday, practicing. My father's music. If you'd play some for me, I'd very much like that.
When we return, Percy says, I'd love to.
Dante beams. The bookstore is not library-sized, which is disappointing, but it boasts a good selection. Crowded shelves are packed into rambling rows, excess inventory stacked at random intervals along the floor. Behind the counter, a headmaster-looking man with majestic jowls glowers. He looks like a bit of a traditionalist, the sort that wouldn't take queries from a lady or a negro boy, nor think either of them has any place in a bookshop. So I sally forth alone. I opt for a daft but earnest approach. Lead with a smile and a stumble, and my shoulders pushed up to make me look smaller and less threatening, though I'm not particularly large or threatening to begin with. Good morning, I say in French. The bookseller tips his bridge specs from his nose and tucks them into his pocket.
May I help you?
Yes, actually, I was wondering.
It's a bit of a slim chance, but if you happen to know what a Lazarus key is, or if you have any books on it. The bookseller blinks.
Are you making a biblical reference?
Am I?
I laugh. He does not.
I don't know. Lazarus is the man Christ raises from the dead, detailed in the 11th chapter of John in the New Testament.
Oh,
that hadn't occurred to me. I've never been an attentive scholar of the Bible, my father being a deist and my mother being of an anxious disposition that manifests most prominently before disagreeable church services.
Yes, perhaps I am.
Then I suggest you study the Bible.
He looks ready to tuck back into the demanding occupation of scowling, but I press on.
What about Baseggio puzzle boxes?
I show him the dimples.
Do you know about those?
He is, tragically, immune.
No.
Do you know what they are?
Young man, do I bear resemblance to an encyclopedia?
No, sorry.
I duck my head in surrender. Thank you for your help. I start to walk away, but then he calls,
We do have a small section on Venetian history.
I turn back. Venetian history?
It's a Venetian name, Baseggio. A patronymic from a Venetian diminutive of the surname Basile. Perhaps you might begin your search there.
A patronymic diminutive of...
That, yes. I understand less than half the words in that sentence, but God bless the book people for their boundless knowledge absorbed from having words instead of friends.
Yes, thank you. I'll try that.
Young man, he calls, and I turn back again.
He gives me a nod, head bobbing, though his jowls all hold their formation.
Good luck.
So, perhaps not entirely immune to the dimples after all. Anything? Percy asks as I return to where he and Felicity are waiting.
Baseggio is a Venetian name, I reply, and Lazarus might be from the Bible.
Felicity claps a hand to her forehead.
I should have thought of that. So, I suppose we can each take one of those, I say. Bible and Venice, and then the alchemy book, and see what we can find.
I the alchemy,
Felicity says.
Venice, Percy says quickly.
I moan, please don't make me read the Bible. Percy gives me a wide smile and touches one finger to the tip of my nose. Should have spoken faster. We spend the afternoon in our respective corners of the bookshop. I read John 11 twice, then do a skim of the surrounding pages to see if any further mention is given to that Lazarus character, though it devolves quickly into less of me reading and more of me trying to stay awake. The bookstore is warm and the chair comfortable, and exhaustion is a house guest that has rather overstayed its welcome. When a bell tower down the way chimes the hour, I stand, stretch my arms over my head, then go to find Percy, first casting a quick glance around for the jowly bookminder, who might be less than keen on the fact that I left my readings scattered across the floor instead of shelving them again, but he's still holding court behind the counter. Percy's at a table by the window, bent over a book with his palms clamped over his ears, the green glass panes casting a jeweled sheen upon his face. He doesn't look up when I sit down across the table, until I nudge his shin with my foot and he starts rather spectacularly. You scared me. Very engrossed in your reading. Did you find anything useful?
Absolutely nothing.
He tips the cover shut with a dusty slap. Not even a mention of the name or a family. Perhaps Viseggio isn't Venetian after all. You? Nothing about a key, though there's quite a lot about that Lazarus chap. One of Christ's showier miracles, apparently. Percy laughs. Oh, please do tell me your version of the story. I lean forward on my elbows and Percy mirrors me, hands knotted before him. So, Jesus and Lazarus are chums, right? And while Jesus is off preaching, he gets a shout from Lazarus's two sisters, Mary and Martha, letting him know that Lazarus is not long for this world.
Mary and Martha, Percy repeats. I don't remember that.
Should have paid more attention in your Sunday services. So, Jesus doesn't come, and Lazarus dies, and he's been decaying for days, when the man himself finally shows up at the tomb.
There's an island, Percy interrupts.
No, it's not. It's a tomb.
Not in the Bible. In Venice. I read about it in one of the books. An island off the coast with a chapel on it called Santa Maria e Marta.
The room seems to hush around us, the soft flutter of pages suddenly shivering and ghostly.
Mary and Martha, I say. Lazarus's sisters.
Probably a coincidence.
Probably, he says, though neither of us sounds as though we really believe that.
We both let that seep into us for a moment, like ink into blotting paper. Outside the window, the sun shifts behind a cloud, casting the room into shadow. Then, under the table, Percy nudges my shin with his foot.
So, tell me the end.
The end of what?
After Christ shows up at Lazarus's tomb.
Oh, so the man himself shows up at Lazarus's tomb, and the sisters and their friends are all wondering what he's doing there, for Lazarus is very dead by then. And Jesus asks the sisters if they believe in him and God and life after death and all that, and they say, yes, fine, but it would have been brilliant if you'd come when we first called, because then our brother might still be alive. And then Jesus says, well, watch this.
Really? Well, watch this.
That's biblical language.
If your Bible is written by Henry Montagu.
He's grinning at me, and I open my mouth to reply, but realize suddenly that beneath the table he's still got his foot on my leg. It's such a light touch I don't notice it until he shifts, toe hooking around the back of my calf, which knocks me straight off course, thoughts dashed to pieces against his touch. It's something like that. His foot slides down my leg, pulling my sock out of place, and dear God, it is stirring in me every sinful desire that I'm rather sure the Bible frowns upon. It's take away the stone or something like that, but my version is a bit better.
Did you say your version is a bit better than the Bible?
Well, the Bible's stale.
Not sure what God's going to make of that assessment.
I swallow as his foot shifts against my leg again. I'm starting to sweat from the effort of keeping still. I think I'm going to have worse than revising scripture to answer for when he and I meet. He laughs, close-mouthed and breathy.
So Lazarus comes back from the dead, is that how it ends?
Walks out of the tomb as though nothing was ever wrong. We look at each other across the table. Our faces feel closer than they did when I first sat down, both of us with our hands clasped before us like we're praying over supper. Percy's got such fine hands, larger than mine, with thin, graceful fingers, and round knuckles a bit too big for him, like a puppy still growing into its paws. For a delirious moment I am possessed by the insanity the poets have called love, and it makes me want to reach forward and take both those hands in mine. He has got his foot making its torturous ascent upward, after all, which feels like an invitation. But before I can, he frowns suddenly and peers under the table. Has that been your leg all this while?
What?
He unhooks his foot from around my calf. I thought it was the chair. Sorry about that. Dear Lord, why didn't you say something? Before I can reply, there's a flump at the end of the table and we both start. Felicity has slammed her alchemy book down between us and is standing over it with her palms flat on the cover and her elbows straight. Did you finish already? Percy asks her. In the second I looked away from him, he's gone and tucked those fine hands out of sight.
I skimmed, she replies. And I knew some from the lecture. It's scientifically sound, as far as I can tell, though I'd always heard alchemy was being disproved. Mostly, his book is a summary of the principles, the purification of objects and returning them to their most perfect state. But then there's a chapter at the end, hardly even a real chapter, it's practically a footnote, about artificial panaceas.
What does that mean? I ask.
One of the pillars of alchemy is creating a single item or compound that heals all ailments and restores the body to its perfect state, she explains. There's no universal one in existence. Mostly they're plants and things that work as antidotes to a wide range of poisons.
Like the chemicals in the study, Percy offers.
Right. But it seems that when Mateo Robles died, his work was primarily focused upon the creation of a universal panacea that synthesized inside a human heart.
How would that work? I ask.
Well, his theory is that the component missing from previous attempts to create a panacea was life. He believed that were the correct alchemical reaction to occur within it, a beating heart could be turned into a sort of philosopher's stone, and then the blood pumped from that heart would take on the same healing properties. I scrub my hands through my hair, tearing a few strands from its queue.
A beating heart and open veins is an altogether different thing than the chemicals in a vial I was expecting.
What if he succeeded? Percy asks. Maybe whatever's in the box has something to do with finding the person with that heart. Or making it. Perhaps that's what the Duke is after.
It seems ill-advised for one man to have access to something like that, particularly one with his hands in so many political pies.
Felicity looks over at me and scowls.
What's that face for?
What face?
You look put out.
Just thinking about all that blood, I nearly shudder.
Doesn't it make you a bit squeamish? Ladies haven't the luxury of being squeamish about blood, she replies.
And Percy and I go fantastically red in unison.
18.
The opera is Friday evening. Helena reminds us over breakfast that morning. Dante nearly faints. I have a strong sense both that this is his first time out of the house in a long while, and that he's not going willingly. We haven't clothes fit for the outing, so Dante lends Percy a wine-coloured suit, noticeably too short in the sleeves, but they're built similar enough that it's passable. I get black silk breeches and an emerald coat that swallows me, but it's the only thing that fits in the tails and the cuffs after I roll them. Twice.
It's my father's, Dante says, with seemingly no understanding of how disconcerting it is to be wearing a dead man's clothes.
When I come into the bedroom, all attempts to convince my shoulders to fill out a smidge abandoned, Percy's perched upon the bed, still not dressed. He's got one leg pulled under him and his violin clenched between his chin and his shoulder. A set of weathered sheet music is spread before him.
Is that the music Dante picked? I ask.
He nods, the violin bobbing.
It doesn't translate as well as I hoped. It's all written for the glasses.
Well old-fashioned, too.
Let me hear.
He twists the end of his bow, arranges his fingers, then plays the first line of the song. It's got a formal sound to it, swallowed and courtly, until Percy confuses his fingering and the strings squeak. He whips the violin out from beneath his chin with a frown, then tries the measure again, plucking out the strings instead of bowing them, with no real mind for the timing.
That was beautiful, I say,
Percy jabs me with his bow right to the stomach, and I flinch with a laugh. You are a menace.
What's that one called?
He squints at the title.
The Vanitas Vanitatum.
Oh. His brow creases.
This is the song.
What song?
The one Dante mentioned, the summoning song for the spirits of the dead.
Trying to call the soul of Mateo Robles. He might be the only one in this damn house willing to tell us about his work.
Percy sets his violin on the bed, then reaches for the clean shirt laid over the headboard, already pulling his arm through his own sleeve.
How soon are we leaving?
Not sure, I reply, forcing myself to avert my eyes as he pulls the shirt over his head. I'll meet you below, shall I?
I snatch up my shoes from beside the door and flee. I'll not torment myself with a half-naked Percy any more than is absolutely necessary. Entirely clothed Percy is almost more than I can bear.
Dante seemed to be hoping that if he sulked above stairs for long enough, he might be accidentally left behind. And I can't imagine Helena is very quick in dressing without a maid, so I assume I'll be the first one down.
The study door is shut, and I pause beside it, tempted to try the handle. My fingers brush the latch when, from behind the door, I hear Dante's voice, pitched in a whine. I nearly jump out of my skin.
Why does it matter if we keep them here?
We need to wait, I hear Helena say,
but the rest of her sentence is drowned out by Percy starting up with the violin again from above. I wish dearly I could throw something at him through the floorboards. I lean into the door, pressing my ear flat against it.
Perhaps they can be persuaded into silence, or they aren't interested.
They are obviously interested.
But they seem so reasonable.
Haven't you learned yet that many seemingly reasonable people are far from it?
There's a shuffling click like pearls sliding against each other as a strand is tugged.
You'll see him tonight. We're running out of time.
What if he isn't?
I'm certain he'll be there. He always goes to play with the magistrates.
Then you...
He won't speak to me anymore. I've pestered him too often. It has to be you.
But I don't...
Please, Dante. If he could only come home.
A shuffling. Dante mumbles something I can't make out.
You'd let him rot away without trying everything, Helena hisses. We keep them here until...
The door opens suddenly, and I about go face first into Helena's breasts, an impropriety so grand it might distract from my being caught eavesdropping. I catch myself on the doorframe and straighten, making a fruitless attempt at playing casual. Helena and Dante are both at the threshold of the study, Helena with one hand down the front of her dress, adjusting the tucker. Her sack gown is pale pink, the color of rose quartz, with a pannier beneath, and her waist pulled so narrow that everything else is pushed upward. Suddenly, nosing into her breasts doesn't seem like such a terrible fate.
I thought you were above, she says.
No, just waiting.
We stare at each other for a moment longer. I adopt my best I was certainly not eavesdropping smile. Helena's eyes narrow.
Coach,
Dante murmurs and darts down the hallway. The front door slams so hard the vials in the study cabinet tremble. Thank God Percy appears on the stairs behind me at that moment, his violin case under one arm.
Oh, where's Dante gone? I thought I heard him.
Hailing a coach, Helena replies, shouldering past me and into the hallway.
We need to go.
Yes, Percy sets his violin inside the study door. Felicity should be down soon.
Helena is still staring at me.
That coat, she says suddenly.
Fashion was the last thing I expected her to remark upon. I shift in the shoulders, and the whole thing settles upon me like a snowdrift.
Bit big.
It's my father's.
Oh, Dante said I could...
I know, she says, turning down the hallway before I can see her face. Just a statement of fact. We arrive at the opera too early to be fashionably late. The singing hasn't begun, but the footlights are being trimmed. The opera house is bright and chaotic, far less gaudy than the one in Paris, but twice as loud.
The chandeliers glimmer like sunlight on water. The footman's gallery is stuffed, aisles crowded with young men coasting up and down for company. In the boxes, women play cards and eat cream-filled pastries brought to them on silver trays. Men are discussing politics. When the singing begins, the noise is amplified as everyone raises their voices to be heard over it. The standing crowd on the stage kick their legs and shuffle from foot to foot, already weary. Percy and I don't go to the Robles' box. Instead, I drag him to the gambling hall attached to one of the upper galleries, looking down over the audience, so we can have a private chat about what I overheard and conspire on what to do. Felicity put up a fuss at being left behind, mostly in whispers as we climbed the stairs with her hand on my arm, so Dante and Helena prancing ahead wouldn't overhear.
"I want to come with you."
"Well, you can't. Ladies aren't allowed." I nearly stepped on her train as she cut the corner of the landing in front of me.
"If you are scheming about the alchemical cures, please do it where I can hear."
"We aren't scheming, we're..." I didn't get to a fib fast enough, and Felicity's eyes narrowed. She darted up the steps in front of me, cutting off my progress.
"You are scheming.
Just stay in the box and keep an eye on Dante, won't you? See if he goes anywhere."
"Don't give me some nonsense task to make me feel included. It's not nonsense, just..."
I didn't know how to finish, so I just flapped a hand at her. Felicity tore her fingers from my arm, straightened her dress, then stuck her nose in the air.
"Fine, don't include me. Perhaps I'll scheme on my own, then."
"I look forward to it," I said, then grabbed Percy by the hand and dragged him away. The gambling hall is gauzy with smoke and hotter than the summer air outside. It's a great effort not to loosen my cravat as soon as we enter. As we wait at the bar for whiskey, I recount to Percy what I overheard. "From what I gather, they're meeting someone here tonight," I finish. "Do you think we could find out who it is? Maybe we should get back to the box and follow Dante if he goes anywhere. Bit conspicuous, though, I suppose. What if it's the Duke he's rallying with? Maybe that letter I found was instructions for a meeting time. I bet it's the Duke. What if he followed us here from Marseille?"
I resist the urge to look around as though he might suddenly materialize at our side.
I look to Percy, hoping he might lend some shears to my intellectual hedgerow, but he's pulling at his coat, fanning the collar against his neck.
"God, it's hot in here.
Are you listening to me?"
"Course I am, but I think you're getting excited over nothing."
"Hardly nothing.
Just because you found one letter from Bourbon doesn't mean they're on familiar terms."
"Then who else would they be meeting?"
"Perhaps it's nothing to do with alchemy, or their father, or us."
Helena stopped awfully short when she realized I was listening.
"Well, you were being rude."
"I wasn't being rude."
"You were eavesdropping."
"No eaves were dropped. I was just standing about. It's their fault they weren't speaking softer. And that's not the point. The point is, something is going on, and I have a sense we're being conspired against. We need to find what we can about Mateo Robles' alchemical cures, and then get away from here. Why aren't you as worked up about this as I am?"
The bartender delivers our shot glasses, and Percy slides one down to me with a smile.
"Because I don't want to worry about that right now. I just want to be out with you. We're here, aren't we? In Barcelona. At the opera. Let's enjoy it."
He traces the rim of his glass with a finger, and it hums at his touch.
"We won't have many more nights like this."
"Don't say that."
"It's true."
"No, it's not. Because we are going to find whatever secrets they have about alchemical cures, and then you'll be well again."
On the stage, the soprano starts in on a punishing first aria at a pitch that makes the air tremble. I wince.
"Here then, let's play a game where we drink every time someone sings something in Spanish."
"Italian."
"What?"
He tips his head toward the stage. "This is Handel, it's in Italian."
"Is it?"
"Definitely Italian."
I decide not to mention how adorable I find it that he knows all that just by hearing a few bars. The soprano strikes another blistering note and I grimace. "Doesn't matter, I hate it."
I tap the rim of my glass against his.
"To beauty, youth, and happiness."
He laughs. "Do we qualify for any of those of late?"
"Well, we are indisputably young. And I am happy, at least right now, because I haven't had a proper drink in a fortnight, and I'm quite excited about this. And you are... I trail off, my neck starting to heat. Percy turns to me quickly, his eyes catching the light and reflecting a mischievous glint. I'm suddenly aware of my body in a way I wasn't a moment before. Every twitch and blink, the way my shoulders sit inside this too-big coat, the bob of my throat as I swallow hard, every point of my silhouette that his gaze touches. Love may be a grand thing, but goddamn if it doesn't take up more than its fair share of space inside a man. I could tell him. Right here, right now, let it out in the light. Percy, I could say, I think you are the most beautiful creature on God's green earth, and I would very much like to find a hidden corner of this opera house and engage in some behavior that could only be termed sinful. Percy, I could say, I am almost certain that I am in love with you. But then I think about that kiss in Paris, the way he pushed me away once I let slip a hint that it might mean something more than a random romp. He's been so fond with me since we reached Spain, in a way he hasn't since before I put my mouth on his that disastrous night. And that feels fragile as spun sugar, too sweet and precious to risk its collapsing. I'm what? Percy asks, mouth curling upward. The singer breaks off, the orchestra lapsing into an interlude. Percy's eyes flit away from me, toward the stage, and I slap him on the shoulder. Yes, Percy, you're very handsome, I say as flippantly as I can muster. Then toss back my whiskey in two quick swallows. It burns as it hits my throat. When I turn back to him, that drowsy hint of a smile has vanished. He shifts so he's propped backward against the bar on his elbows, tugging again at his coat collar to ward off the heat. Then he leans suddenly into me and says, Here, there's something I've been wanting to talk to you about. When we were in Paris... He halts, and my stomach drops. When I look over at him, his eyes are fixed on a point across the room. What about Paris? I say, trying to be dead casual about it, but he doesn't seem to hear. Percy? Look, it's Dante. What? I whip around and follow his gaze across the room. Amid the tables, there's Dante, hands in his coat pockets and shoulders pulled up, like a turtle drawing into its shell. He's talking to an older gent in a white wig and a fine gold coat, his fingers curled over a silver-handled cane. The man smiles kindly at Dante, who looks to be stuttering something, but then shakes his head. Both Percy and I keep silent, though we're too far away to hear anything being said. The man bends down, forcing Dante to meet his eyes, says something that makes Dante go red, then makes to clap him on the shoulder, but Dante steps out of the way, and instead he ends up swatting the air between them. The man smiles, then starts off toward the gambling tables, while Dante flees the other direction, through the doors and back out to the boxes. Do you think that's... Percy starts, but I'm ahead of him. We need to talk to him. Who, Dante? No, whoever that is. I flail a hand at the white-wigged cove. He's already settled himself at a hazard table across the room. For a man with a cane, he's a speedy bastard. Let's have a game, get him talking, ask about the Robleses, see if he'll tell us anything. Maybe he knows about their connection to the Bourbons, or what their father was doing with his alchemy, or anything about them. I start toward the table, but Percy catches me by the back of my coat. Hold on, they're not going to let you sit at a gambling table for a chat. We're going to have to bet. Oh. I glance over. There are only three empty seats left at the man's table, and one gets snagged almost as soon as I look. I'll get chips, Percy says. You corner him. Brilliant. I start away again, but then double back to him. You all right? Fine, he says, though he's plucking at his shirt. It's so hot is all. We'll make this the quickest card game of our lives. Meet at the table. I sidle through the crowd, trying not to look like I'm making a charge for those two empty seats. A pair of swains are standing behind them, talking, one of them with his hand resting on a seat back, but I dive in before they can and fall, a little less gracefully than I had hoped, into the chair beside the man Dante was conversing with. He glances up from his chips and gives me a smile. I offer a big one in return. Not too late, am I? I say in French. Not at all, he replies. Welcome to Barcelona. Sorry? You sound foreign.
English. My friend and I are on our tour. He's gone for chips.
We don't get many English tourists here. How did you make your way so far south?
Oh, this is going splendidly.
We're visiting friends, the Roblers family.
His eyebrows meet in the center of his forehead.
Oh, are you?
Waiters, please, gentlemen,
the caster interrupts.
We're ready to begin.
I resist the urge to glance around for Percy.
Do you know them, the Robleses?
In a professional capacity.
I spoke with Dante earlier tonight, actually.
I'm not what might be called accomplished at subtlety, but asking forthrightly, and what did you two speak about, seems excessively bold. So instead I say,
what's your profession?
I serve as warden of the city prison. Rather grim, I know.
That was not what I was expecting. He shuffles his chips between his thumb and forefinger, then tosses a few on the table for the caster.
Good for those poor children to have some company after all they've been through with their parents.
I'd hardly call either of the Robleses a child, but I don't correct him. There's a tap on the table in front of me, and I look up. The caster is frowning.
Your waiter, sir.
Just a moment.
I lean into the warden. I'm quite concerned about Dante, actually. I haven't seen him since his father died, and he's been so tight-lipped about it ever since.
Died?
The warden interrupts.
He hasn't died.
But he's...
What?
Sir,
the caster says.
The wager.
I try to swat him away.
My friend's on his way.
Sir!
What do you mean he isn't dead? I demand. The warden looks rather alarmed by my vehemence, but says,
Matteo Robles is a Habsburg sympathizer, jailed for refusing to aid the House of Bourbon when they took the crown.
My heart is really going now.
You're certain?
I've been charged with his care by the king. He's housed in my prison.
To his children,
sir,
the caster says. If you won't be wagering, I'll have to ask you to leave.
Fine, I'll...
I stumble to my feet, searching for Percy. He's a hard fellow to miss, but the crowd is thick and the air smoky, and I am more than a bit flustered.
I'll be right back,
I say, partly to the caster, but mostly to the warden, then shoulder into the crowd. He's alive is thumping through me like a heartbeat, and I'm tripping myself trying to work out what this means. Matteo Robles is alive, though both Dante and Helena had assured us he was dead. Dead as Lazarus. And here he is, risen again. I do two laps around the hall before the realization that I can't find Percy kicks its way through my discovery. He's not at the chips table or at the bar where I left him. I can't think where else he would have gone, and I'm starting to get frantic. Where are you, Percy? And then I spot him slumped on the ground beside the door, his head between his knees and his hands shoved into his hair. My heart stands still for a moment, then begins to pound again for a new reason entirely. I shove through the crowd, with no care whatsoever for who I'm smashing into, and drop to my knees beside Percy. I touch his arm, and he starts more than I expected. When he looks up, his face is drawn, thin beads of sweat gathering along his hairline.
Sorry, he murmurs.
What's wrong? Is it...
Are you about to...
He pushes his face into the crook of his elbow.
I don't know.
Right.
Well...
Right.
How about maybe...
Maybe...
I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
I'm fishing bare-handed in my stream of consciousness for some way to take charge of this situation and be what he needs, and I'm coming up empty. Do something, you imbecile.
Let's go, I say, which seems like a good place to start, and I help Percy to his feet.
He sways unsteadily, though that might just be the crowd jostling us. I slide his hand around my arm and lead him out of the hall. The truth about the Robleses taking second place to Percy. Everything will always be second to Percy. I'm not certain if he's about to fall into a fit or how long we've got if he is, or if there's anything I can do to stop it. He's clutching my arm as I lead him down the stairs and through the lobby into the courtyard, which, thank God, is cooler than inside and nearly deserted. In one corner, a grove of lemon trees clings to the stone wall, branches bowing under the weight of ripe fruit. I walk Percy over, hoping there'll be a bench or at least a hefty rock. But he doesn't seem to give a whit about the seating, for he sits down on the grass, then falls backward with his knees up and his hands over his face. He's breathing rather fast.
Please, not now,
he murmurs, so soft I'm not certain he knows he spoke aloud. I'm fighting the urge to go fetch Felicity because she's so much better at this than me. Probably would have, if it didn't mean leaving him on his own. I haven't a clue what to do, so I clamp onto the first idea that arrives before I have a chance to really consider it. I crouch down.